Okay, Democracy 101. Why do we have free elections?
You all realize why we have free elections here in the United States with a secret ballot. It's so important that we keep the integrity of the polling place so that we can do what we need to do.
Yikes. Perhaps what we need to do is all get on the same page regarding the way we vote in America. A new documentary looks at polling problems in the 2004 election. Can they be fixed in time for November? Repeating history we'd rather forget. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 1st, and we're also looking at China and Tibet renewing difficult negotiations over issues likely to follow Beijing to the Olympics. Also, wildfires in the West. John McCain takes his campaign on the road to show his statesmanlike side. Hospitals coming clean on some fatal mistakes. And Starbucks decides mellow music is bad for business. Maybe. That and all the news. The U.S.-led coalition says warplanes have attacked large groups of insurgents in eastern Afghanistan and killed more than 30 of them. Fighting between militants and security forces is intensifying in Afghanistan. More than 2,100 people have died in the violence so far this year. A Saudi man accused of organizing and directing the 2000 attack on the USS Cole has signaled his treatment in U.S. custody could be an issue if his case goes to trial. Brigadier General Thomas Hartman, legal advisor to the U.S. military, says the CIA has admitted to using waterboarding during his interrogation.
While there has been an admission that there was waterboarding, there may well be other evidence in the case. That's not necessarily the only form of evidence in the case.
The Pentagon says it will have to be decided at trial whether any confessions that resulted are tainted.
Former detainees of the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq are suing U.S. contractors in four states for alleged torture. The complaints say innocent people who were arrested and taken to the prison were subjected to inhumane treatment. They were later released with charges. Katie Gallagher is a lawyer assisting the plaintiffs.
The conditions that they were detained in were horrific. They were kept in cold cells. Often they were kept naked. They were beaten, they were taunted, and they were ultimately tortured.
The charges have been filed against defense contractors Khaki International and L3 Communications, formerly Titan Corporation. Auto sales figures due out today. Analysts are predicting high gas prices and general belt tightening will contribute to a double-digit dip in U.S. auto sales.
In politics, John McCain holds a press conference in Indianapolis, Indiana today before heading to Columbia to talk about free trade. Barack Obama visits a community ministry in Zanesville, Ohio.
Oil prices rising in Asia today, staying above $142 a barrel. The S&P 500 opens at 1280 after flat trading yesterday. Here's a question. Is voting too difficult? What should John McCain be leading with? What's his strongest suit? Here's one of your responses.
Good morning. Mark Meyerowitz from New York. What's up? An important aspect of what McCain should push, his war record, his courageous service, and candidly, people, Americans respect that, and he should be rightly proud of it.
That's John McCain, an assessment of John McCain's strongest suit. What's your suggestion? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
This morning, swaths of California are still on fire. They could be the largest number of wildfires raging at the same time in the state's history, more than 1,200. Lightning triggered the flames that are now threatening the resort town of Big Sur, among other places. Jason Kirshner of the U.S. Forest Service joins us now from Northern California. Good morning, Jason. What's the status of the wildfires right now?
Well, right now we're looking considerably better than we did last week after all of these fires first began. We still have about 408,000 acres of wildfire with right about 600 different starts all throughout California. Now, as I said, that's a little bit better than we were doing last week. We've got about half of them out right now, but it's still a lot of fire, and we've got about 20,000 different people from all across the United States here in California that are helping to fight every one of these blazes.
20,000 people. What is at risk at the moment? Are we talking homes, people?
Right now, we're focusing all of our efforts on these fires that are threatening property and lives. Some of the biggest threats are in the Big Sur area right now. I'm sure most folks have heard about that one, with a fire called the Basin Complex. Our firefighters are working to try and keep the fire out of the area of Big Sur, and also in the hills all around these areas in California. We have a lot of rural homes, folks that kind of live out in the woods, out in these very beautiful scenic areas. Unfortunately, during the summertime, that also puts them at threat. And so on many of our fires, we have evacuations and up to about 10,000 homes at risk.
And I've also read reports that so far no casualties.
That's correct. That's been one of our biggest successes is, you know, although we do have so many fires burning out there, our safety record has been phenomenal, frankly. With this amount of fire, oftentimes it's unfortunate that we end up with people who end up injured, people who end up burned, or with other life-threatening injuries throughout all of these thousands of fires, or more than 1,000 fires that we've been fighting. Nobody has had any kind of a significant life-threatening injury.
What exactly is burning now?
Well, with fire throughout pretty much the entire state, we have fire in just about every ecosystem, whether it's timber up in Northern California, grasslands in the foothills, or brush and chaparral near the coast. The lightning storm that touched all of this off with more than 6,000 lightning strikes pretty much started fires everywhere.
And what's the forecast for today?
For today, we're looking a lot better. Our winds have shifted around. Prior to this, we were getting winds that were blowing out of the Great Basin, out of Nevada and the deserts that were just very warm, dry winds. We've had a break in the weather now, and now our winds are blowing in off of the Pacific Ocean. That really helps us out a lot with cooler temperatures. We get a little bit more moisture in the wind, as well as in the coastal areas where some of these fires are burning up towards Eureka and the Six Rivers National Forest, or down on the Basin Complex near Big Sur. We're getting a thicker marine layer and in some cases fog, and this is extremely helpful to our firefighters.
Fog is helpful because...
Well, it increases the humidity, and a lot of folks talk about, well, we need rain to put the fire out. But the number one thing when it comes to weather that really helps us is high humidity. It allows all the little sticks and branches and the little things that build the fire, build a small fire into a big fire, to absorb that moisture out of the air, and the fire just doesn't burn as intensely. It gives our firefighters a great chance to get up close and put the fire out directly instead of having to back away from it for safety.
Jason Kirshner, many thanks to you.
Thank you.
Jason Kirshner is with the U.S. Forest Service in California. We wish you the best.
Republican presumptive nominee John McCain probably wishes that his campaign was on fire, but in the summer doldrums, it's hard for any of the candidates to hold the headlines for very long. This week, a whirlwind trip to Colombia and Mexico for talks with heads of state. Am I talking about George W. Bush? No, that is what John McCain is doing this week. He's on the road to Colombia on Tuesday, that's today, and Mexico later this week. He will have high-level talks. What is the idea? Is he honing his message and honing his image in the midst of a sort of doldrum campaign season for politics in the United States? Laura Meckler, covering the McCain campaign for The Wall Street Journal, joins us and will be tagging along with John McCain all week long. Laura, thanks for being here.
Sure. Good to be here.
It seems like there's a number of missions for John McCain in these weeks. Number one, to project that he responds quickly to attacks from the Obama campaign or attacks from so-called Obama surrogates. And also, he's trying to hone his image from a variety of snapshots that we've gotten so far. And I'm just wondering if there's a strong one and the campaign believes that McCain has a real strong suit that he should be focusing on at this point.
Well, I think you put it well, which is that the campaign views one of his greatest strengths is his ability to come off as a statesman, somebody who really is comfortable on the world stage. And to that end, he is doing a lot of foreign travel. He's already been to the Middle East. He's been to Europe. A couple weeks ago, he was in Canada, and now South America and Mexico. So he's really trying to project this image of somebody who is comfortable, who's a grown-up, who's a leader, who can be on par with the world's leaders.
What do campaign strategists say are the challenges of making sure that those images, those pictures, those trips make it into the consciousness of voters? I mean, they're not the biggest stories in the news these days.
Well, that's something that John McCain has been fighting for a while now. You know, he basically wrapped up his nomination in February, and there was a very exciting Democratic primary going on, so they were fighting for coverage for a long time. You know, it's, in a way, things are looking better for him, but it's true. I don't think that this is the kind of thing that Americans are going to open up their newspapers and go, what? You know, I just don't think it's going to break through on that kind of level. On the other hand, they say that this is the week before a holiday. Americans are on vacation. They don't really paying attention to politics anyway. It's not like they're losing a big opportunity.
Laura, I'm going to play you a bit of tape that I'm sure you're familiar with, and I'm going to ask you a question, all right?
Okay.
Stand by.
Well, I don't think riding in a fighter plane and getting shot down is a qualification to be president.
That, of course, is General Wesley Clark criticizing John McCain, who, of course, was shot down in Vietnam and became a prisoner of war. Do you think Wes Clark, Laura, did John McCain a favor by saying that, or is that some sort of criticism that really stings him?
I think it actually was a bit of a favor. The McCain campaign wasted little time in highlighting those remarks in the sense of being outraged by the remarks, but gathering a large number of supporters of his own to defend his military record. But, you know, even though they're talking about it in terms of defense, in fact, any day that they can talk about his military experience, they view as a good day on the campaign. So the fact that they are able to sort of take this pose as a victim, if you will, really works well to their strategy.
We should note that Barack Obama has suggested that the remarks were perhaps inappropriate, although Wesley Clark is standing by his alleged criticism. I guess I don't know what you would call
right.
it there.
I mean, you know, Clark didn't say that this disqualified him for president. He was just saying that this is not the same as leading, leading a battalion. It's not the same as commanding troops into battle.
Well, it disqualifies him for being a pilot for American Airlines, perhaps.
That's the idea. True. He has left his wings.
Let's talk about the foreign trip that we alluded to at the beginning of our discussion here. Mexico and Colombia. There are specific reasons why he's going to Colombia. He and Barack Obama differ on this proposed free trade pact that the Bush administration is pushing. How important is it for John McCain to be perceived as, taking positions that are at odds with Barack Obama?
Well, I think that they certainly want to highlight the areas where there are differences, and they think they have a winner on this one. Polling shows that there's actually a lot of skepticism about globalization and free trade, but the campaign really believes that this is a winning issue if presented in the right way. So they are definitely going to be talking about Colombia. They talked about the NAFTA when they were in Canada a couple weeks ago, and they're definitely going to be talking about the Colombia Free Trade Agreement this week.
Maybe this is totally off base, but Laura, is what's McCain's mood these days? Is he the jolly fellow of yore, or is he much more buttoned up than you're familiar with?
I don't think he's in a bad mood. I think he still can be loose, but they definitely have taken a little more control. It's become a much more controlled campaign than it was in its heyday. I think and by heyday, I mean heyday for reporters, in the sense when it was just sort of easy access every single day. You know, he still does take a lot of questions from the press, but it's just not at the same level
right.
that it used to be.
Not in a bad mood, exactly. That's Laura Meckler covering the John McCain campaign for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you, Laura. And we want to know what you think John McCain's strong suit is. Forget about his mood. Don't talk about that. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What's McCain's strong suit? Later on in the program, hospital mistakes and also Starbucks. It's America's extended living room. What do you do in Starbucks besides pay too much for coffee?
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 1st. Some scary headlines out of California this week about serious accidents and mistakes in hospitals, some of them deadly. 1,000 serious patient errors at California hospitals were disclosed in state filings. That's 100 patients injured every month in what are being called preventable events. Joining us now is Joe McCannon, the vice president of the Institute for Health Improvement, a nonprofit agency. He's joining us for the big picture. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
What kind of preventable instances are we talking about in California?
Well, in California, you're talking about several different types of harm. They can be anything from what we would consider really egregious forms of error, like amputating the wrong limb, for instance, all the way to things like having people suffer mildly from medication error or an infection of some kind. So the level of the problem here is something that we actually see nationally, and it's relatively common, unfortunately.
In the medical community, they refer to them as never events, as in something that never should have happened. Explain the purpose of the law in California that now requires hospitals to report these events.
Well, I think the law in California that's been contemplated is a law that will take a first step, and the first step is to make the public aware that these events are happening, to require hospitals to disclose that information. In some states, payer organizations are also requiring that the organizations disclose this information so that they won't actually be reimbursed when a harmful event like this occurs. It's not the whole solution, of course, because we have to help hospitals figure out the hard work of actually solving these problems. But it's a first step in many cases.
Joe, what's the consequence for the hospital? Because as you noted, you're talking about very serious errors in some cases. The wrong person's appendix was removed, or an unattended patient actually died in one of those instances in California. What's the consequence for the hospital?
Well, the consequences for the hospitals can be several. Litigation, serious lawsuits are one possible consequence, but there are other consequences with legislation like this where a hospital will not be paid for the care that's provided associated with the harmful event. It's also certainly the case that reputation can be severely damaged in these instances.
And Joe, you noted that it is a serious problem nationwide. The American Hospital Association reports that 37 million people enter hospitals a year, one in three are injured. And in fact, in 2000, 2001, and 2002, they report that an average of 195,000 Americans died because of potentially preventable incidences in hospitals.
Yeah, this is a very, very serious national problem, and it's one that's relatively unknown. But when we talk about the level of harm that's reported in California, for instance, we're really just talking about the tip of the iceberg there. We estimate ourselves that there are about 15 million patient injuries in U.S. hospitals every year. And again, these range from mild errors all the way to events that ultimately cause people to die.
Well, Joe, is this law on the books or is it proposed? I'm not clear on that.
Well, I think right now the legislation in California is proposed, but there are certainly other states where action has already been taken. In states like Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, insurers have said that they'll stop paying for serious events, never events, and encouragingly, some hospital groups have proactively committed not to charge for these events in Washington, in Massachusetts, Vermont. So I think that this is really a signal of activity to come.
And it's very tricky. And when you were saying that you estimate much larger numbers of people who are injured, explain to us exactly why it is very difficult to nail those numbers down, even in those cases where hospitals are required to report incidences of never events?
Well, I think these incidents will always go underreported to a certain extent, and the reasons for that are that I think in some cases people are afraid. They're not in a safe environment to talk about errors that have happened. These are care providers. In other cases, I think there's just a certain level of reticence about, acceptance of.
But there's also not any uniform standard for hospitals to report this across the nation, right?
There are some federal standards. There are some definitions that exist from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which would help us define what a particularly harmful event is. So that does exist out there. But I do think that just in many cases, some of these forms of harm, the most common are medication error, infection, surgical complication, would be considered almost byproducts of the care process, and we have to change that way of thinking and radically reduce that harm.
Joe McCannon, thank you. Joe McCannon is the Vice President of the Institute for Health Improvement. Now we're going to get some headlines from Femi Okay. Femi?
Good morning. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour, a Saudi man accused of organizing and directing the 2000 attack on the USS Cole was among terror suspects waterboarded several years ago. Brigadier General Thomas Hartman, the legal advisor to the U.S. military tribunal system, says the case can still go ahead despite the CIA's admission that the suspect was waterboarded. It took a while, but Senator Barack Obama and Bill Clinton are talking. Obama asked for the former president's support during their first telephone conversation since the Illinois senator defeated Hillary Clinton. Obama says the Clintons are a key force in making a successful Democratic bid for the presidency.
We need them. We need them badly. Not just my campaign, but the American people need their service and their vision and their wisdom in the months and years to come.
Bill Clinton was one of Senator Obama's fiercest critics during the primary season and back on the primary trail, or back on the campaigning trail, I should say. Barack Obama will be in Ohio today speaking about federal funding for religious charities. And John McCain heads to Latin America, where he'll meet with Colombia's president to talk about free trade. The head of the FBI says that last week's Supreme Court ruling that tosses out a handgun ban may hurt anti-crime efforts. Robert Mueller says that communities will have to decide their own licensing programs, and the ruling throws a lot of things up in the air. And finally, police all around the country are trying to save money. Some are getting back onto their bikes rather than using their cars. And motorists in Atlanta are helping. When they're being nabbed for speeding, they now have to pay an extra $12. That's the cost of catching them. Starting today, the $12 fine will be tacked onto fines for speeding in a bid to cover the rising price.
Motorists in Atlanta are helping. I don't think it's voluntary.
They have cheap gas in Atlanta. I remember it well.
Yeah, right. Well, the poor motorists of Atlanta are
it's not
coughing
voluntary.
Up an extra 12 clams.
Mandatory, I believe.
Mandatory, yes, mm-hmm. I believe. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Hi, my name is Wenda, and I live in Chelsea, Mass. I think that a major obstacle to voting is that it's done during work days, and I think there should be, like in other places, a holiday for voting.
What do you think? Is voting too hard? Tell us your story about obstacles or not. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The presidential election is just 4 months away when you will get to vote. It's worth remembering, though, democracy isn't always on time.
I get down here and I gotta wait 2 hours? I was born in this country. My right is to be able to vote. This is intimidating. No telling how many people have left because of this situation.
That's a scene from November 2004 that director Katie Chevigny and crew captured on voting day. They followed 11 stories in half a dozen cities as different as Dearborn, Michigan to Pine Ridge, South Dakota. In her documentary Election Day, which airs on PBS tonight, and it has some possible lessons for the upcoming 2008 voting day. Katie joined us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So what lessons did you learn that we can apply this year?
Boy, a lot of things. I mean, the main one is that a lot of the problems that we saw and heard about that people encountered in 2000 and 2004, the sources of those problems are still there. People are going to have problems going to the polls in 2008 in lots of locations for sure.
Describe your documentary.
It was kind of a crazy operation, really. We had 14 different crews all over the country, and they were all filming on the same day, just the one day, November 2nd, 2004, and they started filming at dawn and filmed till midnight, and each crew was following one particular character or one particular location, and the idea was to show the contrast and similarities in voting experiences around the country.
There's something very ordinary about all of the characters, just everyday folks who have a tremendous amount of respect for voting, so much so that many of your characters were actually involved on that day. You want to tell us about one of them?
Sure. One of the characters we followed is an international monitor from Australia this was the first election where we actually had international monitors observing our U.S. elections. You know, typically we often send people to other countries to observe their democracies. So when we were in pre-production and we heard that this was the case, I thought that would be great to see what that's like. And so this woman, Shanta Martin, was in St. Louis, Missouri, and she actually saw some of the most egregious footage we got in terms of real disparities in the polls.
And what did she conclude?
She actually made a report for Fair Elections International afterwards in which she... One of the things she reported is that there were fewer poll workers and polling machines in the polling places in the poor neighborhoods compared to the polling places in wealthy neighborhoods.
But there were also a lot of Americans who were gathering, and particularly you followed a Republican monitor who was going into a Democratic stronghold to make sure that democracy was indeed taking place.
Right. That was actually a story that we thought would be interesting. I used to live in Chicago, so I'm familiar with what a political town it is and such a Democratic machine stronghold, of course. So we followed a guy named Jim Fuchs, who's a Republican who was determined to make sure that Republican votes got counted in Chicago and that Democrats didn't intimidate Republicans in the very liberal 44th ward from voting.
And you also were in Ohio. And let's listen to what this man told one of your producers.
No one is having their vote taken away. And if you don't have the right to vote, if you haven't registered right, if you can't find your polling place, maybe you ought to concentrate on other things that are important in your life. If people feel it's their God-given right instead of the privilege that it is.
But you also found that even those people who were trying to exercise that privilege had a really difficult time, and you found that in multiple locations, right?
Oh, yeah, indeed. I mean, part of the reason we included that quote from Cincinnati is because Americans really see elections based on their own experience of going to the polls. And some people have a really easy time going to the polls. And then other people are waiting in line 2 hours, 2.5 hours, getting turned away from multiple locations. And so typically what we found is people are not exposed to the other's experience. And so that was part of what we were hoping to show with the film. It's like, you may know your voting experience, but I bet you don't know all these other ones that people are also...
Because some people are voting with paper and pencil, some people are voting electronically, some are voting ballots, but there was lots of human errors that you came across.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was really, the devil in the details was sort of the theme when we were editing just about everything. Like there were so many more than we could possibly include in the film. Everything from, there's lots of opportunities for human error, but there's 4,600 different voting systems in this country. And of course, some of them work better than others. They're not all equally effective. It's just an incredibly highly localized system. So there are places where people kind of found some ballots they didn't know what to do with, and they would put them aside and try to remember to put them in the ballot box later.
Well, even your guy Fuchs touches inadvertently some election materials that he admits on camera he's not supposed to touch. So there is a kind of mushy human granularness to this process. As you watch the documentary, though, over time, you begin to wonder, Are any of these decisive? And maybe any of them could be decisive. We know from 2004 that there's a debate over what happened in Ohio. But in general, these errors, it's unclear whether they affect an outcome. They certainly do affect an individual's sort of precious sense of having been counted in an election.
Right. Well, we do have one story that takes place in the panhandle of Florida, where there's a sheriff's race that's decided by a difference of about 69 than 115 votes, and they have to do a recount and hand count them. And, you know, a local, that's an election that can be, that was, could have been affected by somebody miscounting some votes or putting some votes in the wrong place, some ballots, I mean. So, yeah, I mean, if you think of, and then those local outcomes, of course, do eventually ripple out to national outcomes. If you become sheriff, then you can run for, you know, lieutenant governor, et cetera. So without a doubt, it can affect outcomes. And the other concern, though, which I think we should keep in mind, is that if people aren't feeling sure that their vote is necessarily going to be counted properly, and many Americans feel that way, people are going to be less inclined to make an effort to go to the polls. I mean, people feel that way already now. So if you're kind of like, well, my vote might get counted, might not get counted, and that's not good for our democracy. I mean, that's going to have a ripple effect that's surely going to affect civic action as well as outcomes of elections.
Mm-hmm. And you're concerned that things could actually be worse in 2008. All of these little incidences that you're talking about could actually increase exponentially. Why?
Well, sure. I mean, part of the reason we saw problems in 2000 and then 2004 is because there was such higher voter turnout than was expected. So that's partly why there were such long lines, because the polling places weren't actually prepared for the kind of turnout we saw. And, you know, if 2008 isn't a high turnout election, I think we're all going to be very surprised. And there's no real evidence that, you know, lots of states have prepared for maybe double the number of people who are going to come. So whenever there's high turnout, then there's a lot more chaos and craziness. And then the fact that the poll workers are poorly trained really becomes a problem, or maybe
sounds
it's
like
not a problem if nobody...
Sounds like a sequel.
No, I'm not doing it. Somebody else can make that movie.
Katie Chevney, thank you. She is the director of the POV documentary Election Day, which is airing tonight on PBS.
Is voting hard? Charles just left us the message. I think that voting is just about the right level of difficulty in this country. Consider, for instance, why children are not allowed to vote, because they're not educated enough, or not smart, or not mature enough. People who can't register are probably pretty stupid. Thanks, Charles. And you can leave your voting uphill battle story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And we'll certainly have more stories about the upcoming election, about voting, about the voting machines, about the problems or not that many municipalities are finding.
The turnout is definitely going to multiply the errors on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
A little history this morning. It's a book of towering importance, up on the shelf there with other volumes that created huge revolutions of thought, like Capital of Karl Marx or even the Bible. The book is On the Origin of the Species, and 150 years ago today, Charles Darwin presented his theory of evolution and natural selection at the Linnaean Society of London. A year and a half later, it came out in book form. The theory of evolution and natural selection came with powerful evidence from Darwin's observations of animals all over the world, and it directly challenged then prevailing scientific doctrines of spontaneous generation, as well as the widely held religious beliefs that the Creator ordained the laws of nature.
There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one. And that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved.
The language is from the 19th century, but that's the voice of author and biologist Richard Dawkins reading the final words from On the Origin of Species. When Darwin's theories were first published, they came under harsh criticism from the religious and scientific community. Here, in a reenactment for WGBH's Nova, esteemed 19th century anatomist Richard Owen gives Darwin a piece of his mind, which he insists has nothing in common with the monkeys.
You should be ashamed of yourself. Your book is a snub to the clergy and an insult to humanity. It's nihilism. Only a man devoid of a soul could find solace in a bestial ancestry.
And that was just the beginning of a continuous debate about evolution. In July 1925, the mixture of religion and science caught fire in the crucible of the Dayton, Tennessee public school system. The Scopes Trial, or Monkey Trial as it was called, dominated headlines across the country. Its arguments over God and biology came straight from Darwin.
Dateline, Dayton, Tennessee, July 11th, 1925. Charles Darwin's theory that all mankind had descended from a common ancestor, a so-called missing link, had set off the fireworks. John T. Scopes, a Dayton biology teacher, had decided to test a new Tennessee law that forbade the teaching of any theory that denied the divine creation of man. He deliberately read Darwin's theory of evolution to his high school class, complete with drawings and all details. And just as deliberately, he was arrested and indicted.
Scopes was found guilty and charged a $100 fine. Within 4 years, anti-evolution bills had been introduced in 20 states. For decades, Darwin was locked out of public schools. He came back in the 50s and 60s when scientific education became a national priority. In 1981, the Louisiana legislature ruled that creationism be taught in tandem with evolution. In 1987, that decision was overruled by the Supreme Court. The passionate arguments from the Scopes trial are echoed today. Here's ACLU attorney Vic Walczak responding to a 2005 ruling that struck down the teaching of so-called intelligent design.
We are absolutely thrilled that Judge Jones has seen through the smoke and mirrors and has ruled that intelligent design is not science, but is in fact a particular religious view.
Religion, science, the debate goes on, and the echoes continue in classrooms today. That's two students, Freena Lynn and Sarah Perkins, who wrote this song about Darwin and uploaded it to Mr. Hand's 8th grade science class in Mansfield Middle School in Connecticut. On the origin of species, from 150 years ago at the Linnaean Society in London to an 8th grade science class today.
Most fit creatures would live and reproduce so that they would pass on their own traits to their offspring.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 1st, and Femi Oke is here with the latest headlines. Femi?
Hello there. 12 minutes to the hour. In Shanghai, an unemployed man is in custody after he walked into a police station this morning and stabbed five officers to death and wounded four others. The 28-year-old was seeking revenge on officers who interrogated him in October. The contract between movie and TV actors and major Hollywood studios ran out early on this morning. The studios have made a final offer worth more than $250 million, and the Screen Actors Guild says it will take more than a day to study it. Drivers in California and Washington State now must use a hands-free device if they use their cell phones behind the wheel, and a new law goes into effect in both states today. Teens under the age of 18 years old in California are also banned from talking or texting while behind the wheel unless it's an emergency. Astronomers from the European Space Agency say that this is the sound of the Earth crying. The crying sound comes from radio waves created when solar wind and the Earth's magnetic field collide. And we often see it as the aurora borealis or the northern lights. And that's exactly what it sounds like. And the radio waves are 10,000 times stronger than even the strongest radio signal. But we don't hear it because we're protected by the Earth's atmosphere.
And you reported earlier this morning that we're getting happier on Earth.
We are. There's a new survey. Yes.
It sounds like we're crying, but we're getting happier.
And Americans are 16 on the list.
Thank you.
I think I might be number one, though.
Yes, and Zimbabwe is at the bottom of the list.
Very bottom list, and that's absolutely true.
Thanks, Pam.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Another headline from China. Talks between Chinese officials and envoys from Tibet's spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, are beginning today in Beijing. It's the second time the two sides have met since the outbreak of unrest in Tibetan areas in March this year. Joining us on the line now from Beijing is BBC correspondent Michael Bristow. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Okay, that's fine.
This is really the first time these sides have picked up talks since the earthquake. Has anything changed, and is there anything different on the table as these talks resume?
Well, we don't really know, because the Chinese government aren't saying anything. They've come out today and they've just admitted that talks are taking place. The Tibetan government in exile, which is based in Dharamsala in India, they've said something similar. But we don't know where these people are meeting, what's on the agenda, or really what's going to come out of these meetings. But if the past meetings are anything to go by, not very much. As you mentioned there, these two sides, they met after the unrest in Tibet in March. They met in May in Shenzhen, a town, a city in the south of China. Not much came out of that meeting. And in fact, talks between the two sides have been rumbling on for about 6 years now, between from 2002, and really they haven't decided anything noteworthy. So really expectations are perhaps being lifted slightly because of the unrest in Tibet and because of the international pressure on China, but I don't really expect anything serious to come out of these talks.
In about a month, or actually a month and a week, the Olympics will open in Beijing. The question is, do Tibetan leaders and Tibetan opposition leaders have a demand on the table that they want some progress on before the Olympics begin as a way of providing some sort of leverage for their mission?
Well, I think that the question suggests that the Tibetans really have some leverage, and I don't think they have. The Tibetan government in exile is based in India. It's got very limited contact and control, well, no control over Tibetan areas inside China, which are controlled directly from Beijing. Tibet is called an autonomous region, but it's certainly the Communist Party based in Beijing which has the area under quite a firm control. So really the Tibetans don't have any leverage. What they do hope for and what they do appeal for, and the Dalai Lama, as he travels around the world, trying to appeal for world leaders to put pressure on the Chinese government to improve the lives of Tibetan people. But they really don't have any leverage. And in many respects, China refuses the idea that they in some way, shape or form speak for Tibetan people.
Certainly a holding pattern between now and the Olympics. At least that's what it looks like from the perspective of Michael Bristow, who's BBC correspondent reporting from Beijing. Thank you, Michael. And now the morning's getting going here. I mean, if you're caffeinated, this is going to help you get to an even higher level of alertness and awareness.
At the end of the end, it's the start of a journey.
All right, maybe I was kidding. That's kind of mellow Paul McCartney there. Maybe it isn't waking you up. Maybe it's putting you to sleep. But it is getting towards the end of music sales at your local Starbucks. The company has reportedly decided to pull back on selling music in the stores, and we'll try just selling coffee. By September, most of CD racks in the stores are going to be gone. This has been picked up by bloggers on the internet, even though Starbucks itself has been cagey about a new policy. Bill Wyman joins us. And he's the former arts editor for Salon and now writes the blog hitsfill.org. Bill Wyman, so what do you think is going on at Starbucks? It's our living room after all, huh?
Hey, good morning. I think, number one, I think as the company is facing its stock market problems and problems of declining just clientele, I think they're saying that the music division, even though I think it was profitable for the company, is more of a distraction than it is an asset at this point.
Does that mean that this notion of Starbucks as a kind of living room of America, where you can drink expensive coffee and get online and listen to music like Paul McCartney, is going away?
That's interesting. I think that Howard Schultz, who's the big CEO of the company during its growth period in the 90s and who came back earlier this year, I think he's the person who promoted the idea of Starbucks as the so-called third space, the place you go to between your office and your home where you live in that sort of an existence. I think that has to still be part of the company's plans. But music fans, it's slightly different. Some people really like music, other people don't. Some people want to go to Starbucks and they love the idea of some tasty tunes being channeled into them. Others perhaps just want to sit and concentrate. So maybe music isn't necessarily a part of that.
There's a lot of merchandising that goes on in Starbucks. I mean, what do you make of the Aquila and the Bee project? I mean, that movie was all over Starbucks. Did it have any impact on Aquila and the Bee's box office?
In a relative sense, definitely, because Starbucks is a great marketing partner to have. That brings up one of the really great issues about Starbucks and the work of Starbucks and the cultural sphere, which is that these are enormous marketing deals, and when the media focuses so much attention on it, when you think of the number of broadcast hours and print pages that were devoted to Starbucks getting into movies, it's extraordinary. And if you go back and look at what actually happened, is the producers of Aquila and the Bee, which is Lionsgate, they paid Starbucks, essentially, to help promote their movie.
They got the promotion, but it sounds like Starbucks, aside from the fees they got from Lionsgate, didn't get much out of the deal.
Right, absolutely. And it's one of these movies that has a bad title and isn't really a crowd-pleasing movie, and Starbucks can probably justifiably say that we like the movie, we're proud to have associated with it, but it's really not that much different from a Happy Meal, Chronicles of Narnia figurines and a Happy Meal at McDonald's.
Right. So, Bill, what's the silliest thing you've ever done in a Starbucks besides drink overpriced coffee?
The silliest thing?
Silliest thing. I'm sure you've blogged from a Starbucks, right?
Oh yeah, well I've sat there. I mean, I've worked. Actually, to tell you the truth, I don't really do that much in Starbucks because they charge money. It's not like it has open Wi-Fi and things like that. But definitely spending that much money on a cup of coffee, and also even spending the amount of time I've had to think just as a journalist about the Paul McCartney deal.
That's Bill Wyman, who's a former arts editor for Salon. He now writes the blog Hitsville.org.
We want you to keep your responses coming to anything you've heard on today's show. Ooh, some more Kenny G.
Yeah, Kenny Send G was the first. He was the first musician at Starbucks, actually.
Smart man.
Portrayed, yes. And he was man. One of the first investors in Starbucks.
First 10, I think you told me earlier. Yeah. Send us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're talking about voting. We're talking about Kenny G, sort of, at least as it relates to Starbucks. John McCain, Tibet, and the business model of Starbucks. Here's what some of you commented on.
My name's Ron, and I'm calling from the Boston, Massachusetts area. Not that it was really silly, but my husband and I actually signed a marriage license and met with the Justice of the Peace outside at a Starbucks cafe in Arlington, Massachusetts. And that's where our wedding was finalized.
Willie wrote to our website about Starbucks. I have a takeaway. Do you know where the shop got its name? Starbucks was a Melville icon, first mate to Captain Ahab in Moby Dick. Here in New Bedford, Mass., home port to the Pequod and many 19th century whale ships, and a 21st century mega fishing port, we have no Starbucks, says Willie. Coffee is regular. You know what I mean?
I know what he means. Yes. I'm from Massachusetts. And we did talk about voting, and here's what one of you told us.
Hi, my name is Nancy Kemper, and I'm calling from Roslyn Heights, New York. In response to the woman who said we should vote on a holiday or a weekend because it's too difficult to vote during the week, she's obviously unaware that her employer must give her time off to vote. Thank you.
That's good to know.
What are the uphill battles you have to go through to get your vote to count? And if you were John McCain's advisor, what would you tell him? The takeaway from McCain today?
I don't think he's in a bad mood. I think he still can be loose.
Thank you, Laurie Meckler of the Wall Street Journal.
On our website, www.thetakeaway.org, you can also check out our Facebook game, the 2008 Veep Stakes Buy and Sell Potential Running Mates for Barack Obama and John McCain.
That's the takeaway. Are you caffeinated now?
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.